Okay. If everybody could find a seat, we can get started with the session. I know with our room change and things, there may still be people trying to find where we are, where we're located. There are any seats left? A few seats around the edges. And more chairs coming in. Great, thanks. Well, welcome. I'm David Pumphrey. I'm co-director and senior fellow for the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. And it's really a pleasure to have this presentation on the BP Energy Outlook 2030. We've been trying to build a library of forecasts that have been coming out recently, and we're putting those up on our website so that people can begin to look at the differences and the assumptions that go into it. And it's really great to have the opportunity to have the presentations in person, not just be pulling them down. Today, Mark Finley, who's the General Manager for Global Energy Markets and U.S. Economics, will be providing the presentation, and I'm assuming we'll take a few questions at the end, or do you have an hour and a half worth of presentation?
So, definitely not.
Okay, great. Mark, today we've got David Nagel, who is Executive Vice President for BP America. David, where were you? Okay. And then Greg Saunders, who's a Senior Director for International Affairs for BP as well in the Washington office. So I think Mark is going to rely on them to answer the bigger BP questions once you stray out of the economics part of this. So why don't we do one thing first? I know it's kind of a big group, but I think it might be useful to go around very quickly around the room and have people introduce themselves and their affiliations. So, Nick, do you want to?
Right. I'm Nick Snow. I'm with Oil and Gas Journal here in Washington.
John Shager, Strategic Petroleum Consulting.
For your sound system, do you prefer that I speak into the mic? Okay, so I shouldn't be my half Italian self and walk up to the stage and wave my hands? Okay. Just want to make sure. Well, let me add my thanks to Greg's, to all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to join us for the presentation and what I hope will be a conversation as well around the energy future for the world as a whole and here in the United States. And let me add my thanks to Dave and Frank and Sarah and the program here for hosting us today. Greg mentioned that our outlook is a point forecast. It is not a scenario. And the objective, of course, is not to be right to the second decimal point, but rather to reveal the broad trends that we see in place, where we see some of the key uncertainties playing out. As Greg mentioned, it's not necessarily what BP would wish to see happen. It is our best effort to be as objective as we can be based on what we can see today. One thing that we think differentiates our outlook from some other long-term energy outlooks that are out there is that we do try to anticipate how policy may change and evolve over time rather than using what is currently on the books, which at least is my understanding of how the Energy Department is required to work when they produce their long-term outlook, or the International Energy Agency, which does a case of aspirational policies, whereas we try to actually consult with policy experts to see what we think is most likely to happen. And we take into account the expected evolution of technology, the world's economy, et cetera, as well, to build what we think is the most likely outcome for energy outlooks. And having just come through Groundhog Day, I can say that one of the benefits of doing this project annually is that if things change, we have the luxury of updating our views next year. So what we'll do today is begin with an introduction of looking at some of the high-level energy trends and the findings from this year's outlook, and then we'll drill down, pun intended, in more detail on the findings fuel by fuel before concluding with a high-level look at some of the implications from this outlook. First, to set the baseline on the global energy trends, this chart breaks out the some of the key factors that underpin our outlook, and throughout we will break down data into the OECD and emerging markets. The OECD is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that. It's essentially the club of mature market economies in North America, Western Europe, Japan, etc. That's not where the action is. As you can see in this chart, The majority of the growth in the world's population, the majority of the growth in the world's economy, and the majority in our outlook of the growth in the world's energy demand all take place in the emerging economies. In fact, to put some numbers on it, more than 90% of the growth in the world's population, about 75% of the growth of the world's economy, and in our outlook, 93% of the growth of energy demand take place in the emerging economy. This chart shows our energy economy, our energy demand outlook, and it's the same data sliced three different ways. A brief note, first, we convert all forms of energy into the equivalent of a billion tons of oil to allow us to make comparisons between fuels. So those will be the standard units in the presentation unless we note otherwise. We're showing you the last 20 years and the next 20 in our outlook. And overall energy consumption in our outlook grows by 1.6% per year, or about 36% in total over the actually 19 years of our forecast, with 2011 being the base year. That is slightly slower than the growth rate we've seen in the last 20 years, and you can see on the far left panel, again, 93% of that growth is in the emerging economies. The center panel breaks it out by sector, and the key point here is that, of course, the majority of energy demand growth, what really drives energy demand around the world, is power generation. In our outlook, power generation accounts for 57% of all of the growth in the world's energy demand over the course of our outlook. Other sectors, in the final use, industry is the leading sector and the most rapidly growing. Transport is by far the slowest growing fuel in our outlook. On the far right, and we'll come back to all of these themes as we go through it. On the far right, we break it out fuel by fuel. Every form of energy grows in our outlook. Oil is by far the slowest growing fuel in our outlook, growing by less than 1% per year. Among fossil fuels, the fastest growing fuel is natural gas. But by far the fastest growing group of fuels in our outlook are renewable forms of energy, which grow by a little over 7.5% per year, every year, over the forecast interval. That's, in other words, renewable forms of energy grow nearly five times faster than the rest of the energy complex. But as you can see, from a very small base. What it means is that in our outlook, the world is still dependent on fossil fuels to meet 80% of the global energy demand, down from 85% today. This next chart breaks out growth increments over the forecast interval. So this is the total growth that we expect to see. And once again, it is the same picture repeated twice. On the left-hand panel, we show it on a regional basis, and on the right-hand side, on a fuel-by-fuel basis. So you can see on the left-hand side, again, the majority of demand growth across all sectors of the economy are the emerging economies. And we, in particular, see very strong growth in Asia-Pacific, and we've broken out China and India here, but also significant growth in the Middle East. On the right-hand side, we break it out on a fuel-by-fuel basis, and a few things to point out. First of all, you can't add all of this together because there is some double counting. You'll see that there's a dotted line separating power generation from the final sectors. You'll also see that power shows up as an increment in the individual final sectors. And so you can see, for example, that in industry and in other primarily residential and commercial applications, much of the growth of final energy demand is met by electricity. You'll see that there's not much electricity in transport. We'll come back to that. The other thing I would point out is the amazing diversity of fuels that go into meeting the growth of power generation. And again, power is what dominates our outlook. And you can see that here, every fuel is present in helping to meet the world's growing demand for power. Every fuel but one, that is. Oil, not there, not used to an appreciable degree to generate power, and certainly not growing in our outlook. The biggest single contributor to the growth of power generation in the world in our outlook is renewable forms of energy. And in fact, if you count hydro and nuclear, the majority of the growth of the world's electricity generation in our outlook comes from non-fossil forms of energy. Now, for completeness, we also want to show you the supply side of the ledger. And again, it's the same picture repeated twice and sliced different ways. As is the case for demand, the majority of the growth of energy supply in the world comes from the emerging economies. Not quite to the same degree that we see for demand, but still almost 80% of the growth of the world's total energy production comes from the emerging economies. Now, on the right-hand side, we break it out on a regional basis. And personally, I was surprised when I built this chart that it is actually Asia is and remains the world's biggest energy-producing region. In fact, Asia accounts for half of all of the growth in the world's energy production over the course of our forecast. And while coal, especially in Asia, and especially in China, is a important part of it, it is actually not the biggest part of it. As we will see as we go through the outlook, there's significant growth in production of natural gas, renewables, hydroelectric, and nuclear energy, all concentrated in Asia. Now, on the left-hand side of this chart, we're showing the evolution over long history, going back to 1965, and going forward in our forecast, of the world's energy market shares. You can see that the vertical line is marking history and the forecast interval. Today, oil is still the dominant fuel in the world, but rapidly losing market share. In fact, oil has lost market share for 13 years in a row now at a global level. And why? Well, we'll come back to that shortly. You can also see that oil has consistently lost market share over the last 40 years. In fact, the high water mark of oil's global market share was 48% in 1973. And after the first round of oil price spikes and the Arab oil embargo, we've seen oil do nothing but lose market share for 40 years. That continues in our outlook. What gains market share? For the next couple of years, coal, which kind of flirts with oil as the world's leading fuel for most of the years in our forecast. You can see that coal, however, does begin to eventually lose market share as well. What gains market share over the forecast is natural gas and renewable forms of energy. Now, so far in our outlook, you know, like every outlook, we've been presenting some of the key findings, but we haven't really given you a reason to why you should believe us. I'm going to transition into that now, hopefully. And coming from a team of economists, you'll not be surprised that one of the things that we think matters a lot is prices. The panel on the right shows what has happened with the fossil fuel prices over the last 40 years. And here we're adjusting for inflation, by the way. So these are real prices. You can see that all forms of fossil energy have risen sharply in recent years. And in fact, all forms of fossil energy on a global weighted basket basis are at record highs after adjusting for inflation. If we look at just the last 5 years and compare it with the 5 years before that, crude oil prices have more than tripled. Natural gas prices globally have essentially doubled, and coal prices have risen in percentage terms in between those two by about 140%. And now as we go through the presentation, we'll show lots of examples of how we think changes in prices and changes in relative prices between fuels matter for the outlook. The first place where they matter is on the demand side. The panel on the left of this chart shows over very long time periods, since the dawn of the industrial era almost, the evolution of how the world uses energy to produce economic activity. So we're looking at tons of oil per, in this case, $1,000 of real GDP. There's a very clear pattern that emerges over a long study of history here. Countries tend to become more energy intensive as they industrialize. But at some point, as the economy matures and the economy begins to focus increasingly on consumption of goods and services, energy intensity turns over and begins to decline. It's a very clear pattern that we see repeated over and over again around the world. It happened in the United States 100 years ago. It happened in China more than 20 years ago. It happened for the world as a whole already. And you can see that in our outlook, it continues. In fact, in our outlook, energy intensity improves by 31%. That is to say, for a given level of economic growth, or economic activity, rather, the world will require by 2030 31% less energy than it does today to produce the same economic activity. That is an acceleration compared to the rate of improvement we've seen historically, driven in part by the significant increase in energy prices. On the right-hand side, we show the growth over time of the world's economy and the growth of the world's energy demand. In our outlook, the world's economy essentially doubles over the next 20 years, or 19 years, and energy consumption, as I mentioned earlier, grows by 36%. So again, that role of becoming more energy efficient, if you will, or less energy intensive, is a critical part of how the world's energy system will function over the next few years, and a critical driver in meeting the ability of the world's economy to continue to grow economically. So that's the demand side. on the supply side, we can also see already, and in our outlook, impacts of higher prices. This chart starts with the level of the world's demand and supply, and then shows you the growth increments over the next 19 years. We've talked about the demand side already. I won't return to that. I want to focus on the right-hand side, which is the supply side of this. We can see that about half of the growth in the world's energy consumption comes from conventional sources of fossil fuels in our outlook. But that means half doesn't. And the half that doesn't is kind of split between what we're breaking out here for more a more in-depth look this year, tight oil production and shale gas, which accounts for about 20% of growth in all of the planet's energy production, but also renewable forms of energy, which account for 17% of the growth, and nuclear and hydro together, which are another 17%. So in a sense, this data shows that in our outlook, half of the growth of the energy supply on the planet is coming through forms of energy that are in some way related to either market or policy reactions to higher, to expensive fossil fuels. And we'll develop that in more detail. In fact, now. I mentioned we wanted to this year take a bit more of a detailed look at shale gas and tight oil prospects. This has attracted huge attention here in the U.S. and around the world. For reference, what we're showing first on the left-hand panel is the distribution of resources. This is technically recoverable resources as estimated by the International Energy Agency. You can see that North America accounts for about 24% of the world's total. You know, North America is not alone in having an endowment of resources of tight oil and shale gas. For reference, all of the oil shown in this chart, the green bars on the left-hand panel, are equivalent to about 240 billion barrels. That's roughly equivalent to Saudi Arabia's current proved oil reserves. For natural gas, the figures on the left are roughly equivalent to 200 trillion cubic meters, or the equivalent to the world's current proved reserves of natural gas. These are massive numbers. On the right-hand side, we can show you our projections for where the production will be in 2030. And clearly, North America has been the driving force. Our research concludes that it will continue to be. In fact, by 2030, more than 70% of the planet's oil, tight oil and shale gas production will still be concentrated in North America. Although we do see material growth elsewhere, it's not to the same pace or scale that we expect to see, well, we have already seen or expect to see in North America. And why is that? I think, especially for people in this room, this is not new territory analytically. It's not what's below the ground. It's what's above the ground. It is a system of private ownership of land, a political and economic system that encourages and allows private investment to flow to those resources. It's the existence of markets that allow producers to know what their price is and to hedge their production if they want to. It's a highly competitive domestic industry with thousands of players fighting and pushing each other, and a support industry that can quickly move resources around the country and around the world in response to changing circumstances. As we go around the world, we don't see that combination of factors being replicated at least to the same degree that we have seen here in North America. And in fact, we would argue that it's not by accident that North America has been the engine for energy innovation in recent decades, whether it's production offshore, in oil sands, in shale gas and tight oil. It is all of these other factors that are above the ground that have driven that. One factor that we can demonstrate in a chart is the size of the support industry. On the left-hand side, you can see that the United States has the biggest rig fleet in the world. And thanks to our colleagues at Baker Hughes in part for contributing, for making this publicly available data to help with that. And in addition to the size of the rig fleet, it's the activity that matters. And on the right-hand side, what we're showing you is the lines are the level of production in these respective regions over the last 3 years. And then the bars are how many wells actually were drilled. So the Bakken Formation, and this, by the way, spans North Dakota and Montana and includes crude oil and associated liquids from natural gas. Production has gone from about 100,000 barrels a day to 1 million barrels a day within the last 5 years. It's essentially matched the production that we see currently in Colombia. But to get there, you had to drill more wells in a single formation than were drilled in all of Canada for the last 2 years running. And that's not immaterial. Canada is the sixth biggest oil producer in the world. So these are just massively huge numbers. And again, what we've, as we've looked around the world and coordinated with our offices in places like Moscow, Beijing, Mumbai, is that while we see a lot of interest and we do see material growth in the production of both gas and oil from these tight and shale formations, we don't see it being repeated to the same scale and pace. And we'll go to the details when we go through the fuels individually. And we'll begin with oil. On the left-hand panel, we've already talked about the erosion of oil's market share over time and how it's related to prices. Here, by the way, we don't show prices, but rather the burden. It's the share of oil spent relative to the economy. You can see on that basis, prices, while they've gone up, and I see this was actually on the DOE website yesterday as well. No coincidence, I'm sure, that we were in there talking about this a week ago. It's still significantly higher than it had been in recent years, even on that basis. You'll also notice that there is no price forecast in here. We do not make public the price forecast that sit behind this outlook for reasons that I'm sure you can understand. On the right-hand side, we are showing you how much of each of these final sectors is oil's share. So, for example, at the top of the chart in transportation, oil has a virtual monopoly. Around the world today, it's about 94%. By 2030 in our outlook, oil does lose market share in transport. It falls to about 88% of energy consumed in transportation, but still has a massively dominant position, and we'll come back to that. But the point of this chart is to show that where oil faces competition, it has lost market share massively. Oil in the late 1970s accounted for 22% of the world's power generation. Today it's 4%. Remember that chart I showed you with all the different fuels going into power generation? You know, oil is being outcompeted. Similarly, in industrial uses and in other parts of the economy, oil has, and in our outlook, continues to lose market share to other fuels sector by sector. Although in the industrial sector, it's important to note that there is a certain baseline that at least today is required for oil in terms of refining petrochemical processes in certain parts of the world, production of asphalt, et cetera. So there is a certain chunk of industrial demand that is difficult to compete away. So I mentioned transportation, and I mentioned that transport is the slowest growing fuel in our outlook. On a sectoral basis, it grows by 1.2%, well below the average growth rate for energy overall. And what is, first of all, why is transport growing so slowly? Right-hand panel of this chart, massive increases in fuel efficiency. And by the way, you can see in that chart that it's not just the rich countries that are pushing fuel efficiency. There's China, also aggressively improving fuel efficiency. The other key point to make on that front is, what is it that drives that massive increase in fuel efficiency? It is certainly the case in our outlook that tighter fuel efficiency standards are a key driver of that. But that's not explaining why fuel efficiency, for example, in the United States has increased in the last decade. That was a matter of you all putting the Hummer brand name out of business and buying more fuel-efficient cars as prices at the pump went up. And so, you know, there are a combination of factors driving the transport, the improvement of fuel efficiency. So that explains why the overall growth rate of transport energy demand is slow, even as we see continued robust growth in the world's vehicle fleet, primarily in the emerging economies, of course. The other thing that we can show on the left-hand panel of this chart is the composition of energy consumption in the transport sector. I mentioned already that oil today accounts for about 94%, and you see that it does begin to lose some market share by 2030. Both biofuels and natural gas account for about 5% of the energy consumed in the transport sector. In fact, natural gas, by the very end of our outlook, passes biofuels as the second largest source of energy consumed in the transport sector. But why is it so measured? Why is that pace of expansion, and why is the erosion of oil's market share so measured? The first point is that 2030 is not especially a long-term outlook in the automotive sector. You know, vehicles that are going to be on the road in 2030 are already in development right now. The other factor, though, is that, for that basis, if you were to extend this outlook beyond 2030, you would actually begin to see a more material change in the fuels competing in the transport sector. The other factor, of course, is that at least as we array the technological options in this competitive game and try to understand where the competition really falls out, you know, we consult with the automakers and the battery makers and a wide variety of internal and external experts. And what comes out every time is that the low-cost solution to, you know, dealing with higher fuel prices is to make the internal combustion engine more efficient, supplemented by hybrid technology. So that could change depending on relative prices and changes in government policy and the pace of technological innovation. But again, based on what we can see today, it seems to us the most likely path that the world will only very slowly begin to see an erosion of oil's dominance of the transport sector. Turning next to the supply side, on the left-hand side, we're showing you the projection and the history of oil supply around the world. Like demand, oil supply in our outlook grows by about 16 million barrels per day over the forecast interval. And you can see the various components of it here. Everything from the light green bar and above is OPEC's. We separate out crude oil and natural gas liquids because natural gas liquids are not part of the quota arrangement. But everything below that is production outside of OPEC. And you'll see that in our outlook, production outside of OPEC continues to grow. In fact, production, non-OPEC production accounts for a slight majority of the growth of the world's total oil production in our forecast. And as you can see on this chart, the components of that are what are today labeled as unconventional sources of supply. Tight oil, oil sands, biofuels production. You know, we do take account for mature declines in mature provinces, and we'll come back to that. The biggest increment of growth, of course, is tight oil, and we break out the details of that on the right-hand side. In aggregate, global tight oil production rises in our outlook by 7.5 million barrels per day. By 2030, it accounts for 9% of the world's total oil production. And you can see the growth increments, again, dominated by North America. Note the pattern of the shape of the trajectory of growth in North America, how it slows after about 2020. We'll come back to that. You'll see that by 2030, there are material contributions, 1.5 million barrels a day from Russia, 500,000 barrels a day from China, et cetera. With this rapid growth of non-OPEC supply, especially front-loaded in our outlook, notice the dotted line on the left-hand panel. This is OPEC's market share. OPEC's market share erodes significantly in our outlook over the next 5 years or so, and only by 2030 gets back to where it was today. Let's develop that in more detail. Whoops. So first, this chart on the left-hand panel breaks out the increments of growth in our forecast on a regional basis. And for the sake of the preparation of this chart, we've put North and South America together to basically do a Western Hemisphere chunk. And you can see that on that basis, the Western Hemisphere accounts for about two-thirds of all of the growth in the world's oil production in our outlook. And in fact, on the right-hand side, you can see that the Western Hemisphere, at least briefly, surpasses the Middle East as the biggest oil-producing region in the world. In our data, depending on what you believe for Saudi production cuts that we've seen in the headlines recently, and if we include biofuels, the United States could surpass Saudi Arabia as soon as this year as the biggest producer of liquids in the world. Although in our outlook, you'll see a recovery in, as OPEC recovers market share, the Saudis do return to being the world's biggest oil producer in the back years of our outlook. This chart shows our supply and demand balance. And again, the way to read it is we begin with the level of demand and supply in 2011, and then we show the aggregate changes over the forecast interval. So you know, you've heard us before, and you've seen in the chart that BP does not ascribe to the notion of peak oil supply. On the other hand, peak oil demand, we're here. We believe that at least in the OECD countries, oil demand, which has fallen already in 6 of the last 7 years, is likely to remain on a long-term trend decline due to a combination of mature economies, consumer reactions to high prices, and government policies increasingly pushing for more fuel efficiency. So in aggregate, OECD consumption declines by 6 million barrels a day in our outlook. By the way, this is true in the United States as well. But that's more than offset by continued robust growth in the emerging economies, which in total grow by more than 20 million barrels a day in our forecast. And you can see the major increments here. In our outlook, China passes the United States as the world's biggest oil consumer toward the back end of our forecast. And in fact, the emerging economies pass the OECD next year in 2014. On the supply side, I mentioned earlier, we do take account for continued declines in mature provinces like the North Sea, Alaska, and Mexico, but that is more than offset by continued robust growth from the unconventional sources that we've already discussed. Those meet, in aggregate, non-OPEC supply about half, a little over half of the growth, and that means that OPEC gets the other half, and the increments of OPEC production growth in our outlook are also shown here. We separate out Iraq because, at least for now, Iraq hasn't been in the OPEC quota arrangement, and again, we separate out growth of natural gas liquids as well. I want to explore what this means for OPEC in a little more detail, and we do that on this chart. Again, we show on the left-hand panel, once again, showing the momentum and the importance of growth of unconventional supply outside of OPEC. Unconventional supply accounts for all of the growth in the world's oil production in our outlook in this current decade, and another 70% in the next decade. We talked again about how that means that OPEC's market share is likely to erode. You see it on the right-hand panel. In our outlook, the market requirement for OPEC oil actually declines for about the next 5 years before it begins a gradual recovery. The market's requirement for OPEC crude oil in our outlook, or for OPEC supply, doesn't get back to where it is today until after 2020. And of course, as in our outlook, we believe that OPEC will cut production in an attempt to sustain the current market dynamics. And that means that as OPEC cuts production, spare capacity goes up. You see on the shaded gray area here, OPEC spare capacity reaches about 6 million barrels a day later this decade and stays there for about 5 years. We haven't seen those levels of OPEC spare capacity on a sustained basis since the late 1980s. While we believe that OPEC will be able to deliver this, I think we have to acknowledge that it's a key uncertainty for our outlook. And then you can see that OPEC does recover production and market share, as we've discussed earlier, in the back half of this forecast as the non-OPEC supply growth loses momentum. And again, we'll come back to that. But before we do, let me turn next to natural gas. I mentioned earlier that natural gas is the fastest growing fossil fuel in our outlook, growing about 2% a year. You can see on the left-hand side that the growth increments, 37% of the growth in global natural gas production comes from shale. And we break out, again, the details on the right-hand side. Again, dominated by North America, but note that trajectory of rapid growth and then a flattening of production. And then more growth in other regions as described here. Globally, shale gas grows from about 6% of production currently to about 16% by 2030. Now, we want to develop that in more detail, and in particular, we want to look at what role shale production plays in various parts of the world. The way to read this chart is we're showing you the demand profile over time for each of these regions and how that demand gets met. Is it met with domestic production? What type? Imports, exports, et cetera. So North America, continued robust growth of natural gas demand. By 2020 and for the back decade, that is more than half of that demand is met by shale gas production, which grows dramatically. And in fact, by 2030, reaches 54 billion cubic feet a day for the North America region as a whole. You'll notice that we do pencil in some small exports of natural gas from North America. That's both the U.S. and Canada, by the way. That certainly looks to us like a reasonable proposition, although we have to acknowledge that that is contingent on policy decisions that are yet to be made. I mentioned earlier, but we do see shale production growing elsewhere around the world, but not to the same game-changing degree we've seen in the United States. Not much, in fact, in Europe, through to a combination of the work that we've done and others recently looking at both the geologic potential in Europe as well as those above-ground considerations, countries that have banned the practices of hydraulic fracturing, for example, lead us to conclude that we don't see that shale gas production is likely to be a material contributor to Europe's energy or gas balance. We do see gas consumption kind of flat, but with a decline in conventional production, European gas imports in our outlook actually grow by 60%. Then we turn to China. Rapid growth of domestic demand for natural gas. In our outlook, gas doubles its share of China's energy mix, but only to about 9%. So gas is still underweight in China compared to the rest of the world. By 2030, China is accounting for the biggest source of individual country growth of natural gas consumption in the world. And by 2030, China is essentially consuming what Europe does. And you can see that there is a material contribution from growth of domestic supply, both conventional and shale gas, about 6 BCF a day by 2030 of shale gas production, but also significant growth of imports, both in the form of pipeline and LNG. I mentioned LNG. LNG in our outlook continues to grow rapidly around the world. In fact, it grows by more than 4%. That is to say, LNG supplies grow by twice the rate of underlying supply and demand for natural gas. And as a result, LNG's share of the global total rises from about 10% to about 15%. Now, one of the factors that we and a lot of other people have been interested in getting a handle on is the kind of disconnected nature of global gas markets today, and will there be a reconnection? We do believe that markets are diversifying. We show you on the right-hand panel how, over time, the number of transactional partners continues to grow. It used to be, 20 years ago, that the average LNG importer only had two suppliers, and the average LNG supplier only had two consumers. You can see that over time, that web of transactions has actually gotten much bigger. That creates, in essence, we're watching the creation of a marketplace, many nodes of transactions that begin to provide flexibility and interconnections. We do believe that the world's natural gas markets will not be completely integrated by 2030, but I think the trend is in that direction, even though if we think the process is likely to be slow. So again, the global balance. As an economist, I have to show you slides like this. I hope you appreciate that. I can't just talk about supply and demand separately. I have to put them both together. And so here is putting them both together. We look at the level of natural gas consumption and production in 2011 and the total increments of growth. Unlike oil, natural gas consumption grows in the OECD countries. But it is still, of course, dominated by the emerging economies, which account for about 75 to 80% of all of the planet's growth in natural gas consumption in our forecast. On the right-hand side, we've mentioned the rapid growth of shale, which accounts for 37%. But, of course, that means that the other 63% comes from conventional sources of supply. And as you can see on this chart, almost exclusively in the emerging economies. Let me turn next to coal. In recent years, coal has been by far the fastest growing fossil fuel. And actually, the point of the chart on the left is, if you draw the history back a little further, you can really see that the last 10 years has been the historical aberration. It has not always been the case that coal has been the dominant fuel in terms of its growth. And you can see that what has been driving that rapid growth of coal consumption in the world in the last 10 years. It has been China, as the country has gone through a period of unusually strong economic growth and unusually energy-intensive economic development. But remember the chart I showed you earlier, how as a country's economy matures, it becomes less energy-intensive. Here's the impact of it. Growth of coal consumption in China slows significantly, especially in the later years of our outlook. It also is the case that growth of coal consumption in particular slows because we will see, as we'll see on succeeding charts, other fuels beginning to take more of a role in power generation, not only in China, but throughout Asia. In our outlook, China and India combined still, however, account for 93% of all of the planet's growth in coal consumption. And as you can see, we see continued declines of coal consumption in the U.S. and the other mature economies of the OECD. Let me turn next to the non-fossil forms of energy. Here we're showing you the nuclear, hydro, and renewables, and we're separating out the mature economies of the OECD and the emerging economies. You can see that all of the growth in hydropower and all of the growth in nuclear power in our outlook takes place in the emerging economies. In response to the tragedy at Fukushima, we have revised down our nuclear outlook, but only in the OECD countries. We have yet to see the evidence that the tragedy at Fukushima is impacting plans for aggressive development of nuclear power in Russia, India, China. On the other hand, the majority of the growth in renewable energy continues to be in the OECD countries. The growth rates, as you can see, are larger among the emerging economies, starting from a much smaller base. But it's still largely the case that through the combination of subsidies and other forms of government interventions, remain the key driver for the continued rapid growth of renewable power, or renewable energy, especially in power. A bit more on this subject. We asked ourselves, you may have noticed on the first slide we showed you about the market shares, how nuclear grew rapidly on the world scale in the 70s and 80s and then stopped at about 6 or 7%. And it's been flat at that level ever since. In our outlook, renewables by 2030 are approaching that same level. And we asked ourselves, is there some reason why, is there some kind of glass ceiling for new forms of energy that, you know, that hit resistance there? So we did some research, and the answer is not necessarily. The chart on the left shows the rapid evolution of nuclear power and power generation over the 70s and 80s and compares it with the track for renewables in our outlook. It's a very different proposition. Nuclear energy, were big projects in a few countries. In fact, and let me make sure I get this data point right, by the time nuclear power got to 2% of the world's total energy mix, it was in 14 countries. When renewable forms of energy got to 2% of the global energy mix, they were in 92 different countries. So it's a completely different question around economies of scale and the development model. And so we don't necessarily think that there's some limiting factor in terms of size, although, of course, the key issue that we're seeing right now is, can subsidies be sustained as renewables have grown rapidly? And the other question is, can renewable forms of energy achieve economies of scale to drive down costs that will allow them to compete without mandates and subsidies? In our outlook, the growth is rapid, but we have already begun to see countries, especially in Europe, beginning to hit the wall financially, and so we've seen a ratcheting back of some of the subsidies here. On the right-hand side, we're showing you the growth rates in the bar of renewables in power generation, and then the diamonds, the blue diamonds, going up to the green diamonds, show the share of power that's generated today and what it goes to by 2030. You'll see that Europe has the slowest growth rate, and yet it has the biggest jump in share from renewables. That's because power generation doesn't grow very much. You have faster growth rates for power, for renewables and power generation elsewhere in the world, especially in the emerging economies, but overall power generation is growing much more rapidly, and so the penetration rate is slower. Let me turn next and finally in this section of the presentation to power generation. And we talked about how power is the big driver for energy demand in our outlook. What exactly does this mean? When we talk about power demand, where is it? Left-hand side. You can see that by far the biggest role for power today and the biggest growth is in buildings, primarily in the residential and commercial sector. And so when we talk about the growth of power around the world, that's really what we're talking about. On the right-hand side, we show the composition of power generation and how it has evolved since 1970 and how it continues to evolve in our outlook. We talked about how oil lost market share ferociously, after oil prices increased in the 1970s because there was other sources of supply that could outcompete it. At first, it was nuclear. As nuclear began to slow, we saw significant growth in both gas and coal. In our outlook, in the back half of the outlook, gas continues to gain market share. Coal begins to lose market share. And what does it lose market share to? Renewables. So let me then wrap up with some concluding observations on implications. And thanks for hanging in there. And hopefully I've left some time for discussions. So first up, we were interested in this dynamic of, how do resources get turned into production? And so this chart is one way that we've tried to organize our thinking. What you're looking at here is you'll see a set of bars for each region of the world. The first bar is what share of the world's oil and gas proved reserves does that region hold today? The right-hand bar is what share of the world's production of oil and gas do we expect to see, for that region by 2030? And to help make the point even more clearly, we color code the regions. So the green regions today are net importers of energy, and the blue regions today are net exporters of energy. And you can see that there is a dramatic pattern that emerges, that the energy importing countries are much more efficient at turning their resource endowment into production. In fact, in this outlook, the importing regions account for 16% of the current proved reserves of oil and gas, but by 2030, they account for 38% of the production. And even though they only account for 16% of the proved reserves, they account for one-third of the growth in oil and gas production in our outlook. By the way, this is just based on proved reserves, so it doesn't include the shale resources that I showed you earlier, except to the degree that they are already included in national statistics for proved reserves. We've been tracking proved reserves in the Statistical Review of World Energy for 30 years now. Currently, proved reserves of oil are sufficient to meet current production for 54 years. For natural gas, that figure is 64 years. And for coal, of course, it's in excess of 100 years. I'm going to come back to that. We've noted the projections for shale, and you know, as is the case with any time you put a single point on your piece of paper, you have to be significantly humble about what those numbers actually mean, especially for something that's as new and as fast-moving as tight oil production and as shale gas production. So what we're showing you here is our forecast for global production of tight oil and shale gas and comparing it to a range of externally publicly available sources. You can see that we're toward the low end of the range for tight oil production with significant upside potential. Now, remember the shape that I showed you about how North American production rises and then slows dramatically for both oil and gas? That is driven by our understanding of the resources today. However, that's subject to change, of course. As I mentioned, we've tracked proved reserves for 30 years in the Statistical Review. In the 30 years that we've done it, global proved reserves of natural gas have done nothing but go up every single year. And for oil, they've grown every year but one. And that was, I think, 1998, when the price of oil was $10. So there's a very strong pattern over time that our understanding of the resource endowment grows. So if the North American resource endowment continues to, our understanding of it continues to evolve and to grow, that creates upside potential. In fact, North America, I believe, is the biggest source of uncertainty when we compare different people's outlooks. And it's driven around the resource assessment. The other part, of course, is the other source of uncertainty is how quickly do other regions of the world marshal resources to develop their shale resources. So that is an additional source of uncertainty in the outlook. Now remember, because of this plateau of North American production, you can see in the center panel that the role of shale gas and tight oil in meeting the growth of demand in the world peters off in the second half of our outlook. If the upside potential that we've talked about takes place, that may not happen. That has implications too. Remember that we showed you a chart that OPEC capacity, spare capacity, would go to 6 million barrels a day, but then fall off again as OPEC regained market share. If there's an extra 5 million barrels a day of tight oil production by 2030, it means OPEC could be looking at the prospect of carrying 6 million barrels a day of spare capacity or more throughout the forecast interval. On the other hand, another potential observation is that if there is upside potential for shale gas around the world, that might have implications for CO2 emissions, and I'll come back to that. Another thing we can do with our outlook is to look at how energy, import dependence evolves over time. This chart shows, the way to read this chart is for each of the successive fuels, we track whether you're an importer or an exporter across these three major oil or energy consuming and importing regions. And we show you how it evolves over 20-year increments. So China today is the second biggest net oil importer in the world. In our outlook, China passes the United States as the biggest net oil importer within the next 5 years or so. By 2030, you can see that China will be importing as much energy as Europe is. In fact, by 2030, in our outlook, China is importing about 3/4 of its oil consumption. By 2030, in our outlook, Europe is importing 90% of its oil production and over 80% of its natural gas production as well. Meanwhile, look at the pattern in the United States, going in the opposite direction. We do have the United States remaining a net oil importer in our outlook. By 2030, however, imports will have fallen by another 70%. And that's on top of the 5 million barrel a day decline in import dependence that we've seen in the United States just in the last 5 or 6 years. So we see continued dramatic improvement there. And as I noted earlier, we see the U.S. becoming a small net exporter of natural gas and remaining a net exporter of coal. Now, so what? Well, on the right-hand side, here's one of the so whats. What we've done here is take a look at import dependence scaled to the size of the economy. Why does this matter? Well, in the United States last year, energy imports accounted for half the trade deficit, or the trade and services deficit. In our outlook, that essentially goes towards zero. As the U.S. becomes, in our outlook, 99% self-sufficient by 2030. Now, by the way, I deliberately don't use the word independent because that's not, I don't think that that's an accurate portrayal. You know, these are still global marketplaces, and, you know, there are tangible benefits to improving self-sufficiency, but not to the degree of independence, we would argue. And we can come back to that. Now, you notice that I mentioned that China and Europe are both essentially importing the same volumes of energy by 2030. But if we scale that to the size of the economy, you can see on the right-hand side that the burden on China is much less than is the case in Europe because China's economy is growing much more rapidly. By the way, we can do this for the producers, too. In our outlook, Russia is and remains the biggest energy exporter in the world, and you can see exports actually grow, for especially for gas, but also for coal. Saudi Arabia, in our outlook, it regains its position as the world's biggest oil exporter by 2030, even with the gyrations that we discussed earlier. And again, if we scale these relative exports to the sizes of the economy, you can see that Saudi Arabia remains much more dependent on, vulnerable to, exposed to energy exports as a share of the economy than is the case for Russia or, in this case, for Africa as a whole as well. Final slide, and thanks again for hanging in there. You can't talk about energy without talking about climate and CO2 emissions, and so here it is. This is the implications of our outlook for CO2. Globally, CO2 emissions in our outlook grow by 26%. You know, the world is not, and at least by 2030 in our outlook, on a trajectory, you know, to meet the projections of the climate scientists that are needed to stabilize the atmosphere at a 450 ppm concentration. It does not grow as fast as energy overall. Energy grows by 36%, CO2 grows by 26%, because natural gas and renewables are gaining market share from coal and oil. Notice, however, that, remember I showed you earlier the chart that showed a doubling of the economy and 36% growth of energy and a huge gap opening up between the economy and energy demand as the world becomes much less energy intensive or more efficient. You don't see that same gap opening here. To me, the reason is obvious. The reason why a big gap opens between economic growth and energy consumption is because energy consumption is expensive, and there's an incentive to become more efficient. There is no price of carbon, you know, in much of the world, and therefore no incentive for the world as a whole to become less carbon intensive. Let me wrap up. At the end of the day, we do believe that our outlook is an optimistic one in the sense that we believe that the world can have the energy it needs to sustain continued economic growth. The single biggest factor of why the world can have the energy it needs is because it doesn't need as much, because it becomes significantly less intensive or more efficient. But also, those same forces that are driving competition and innovation in the world becoming less energy intensive are also driving the innovation and development of new sources of supply. So again, we see the role and the reaction of consumers and producers alike to changes in prices and relative prices. You know, to the extent that there are still issues out there that we need to be concerned about, climate, energy security, I think that that observation is a very powerful one and points to a potential way forward. Let me just conclude by adding that all of this information is available on our website. We did bring some copies of the Outlook for you all. But there are more resources available. There are single-page fact sheets on the United States, Russia, China, India, other parts of the world. There's a spreadsheet with our data. And coming soon, we will have a mirror image of this presentation with a specific focus on the U.S. and North America as well. So thank you again for your time and attention, and we're happy to take more questions.
Okay, let's give Mark a chance to catch his breath.